Well, I'm Jalene Jackson with Moms for America. Thank you, Maria. My husband, Al, I'm coming from Michigan. Al is in Utah. So Al and I are going to kind of team teach from different screens today. He's doing some business and good things for Liberty there. We did it. This is the last class of the 12-week series of the 5,000-year leap. Under these principles that were embedded in our founding doctrine and documents, we went, you've heard me say this now, 12 weeks. We went from the ox and the cart and the plow and the horse to putting a man on the moon in under 200 years of that Constitution being ratified. These principles of liberty and freedom truly unleashed human ingenuity and creativity and prosperity. I hope that these 28 principles that change the world are starting to reverberate in your soul a little bit, because those are the solutions that is what is ailing us today in our homes, in our communities, in our government. We should know these principles and study them over and over. This is just like, I hope it's just your first time through and that you're going to study and ponder and memorize them so they will come out of your mouth naturally when you're having to defend issues of the day or correct or, you know, stand on that wall and go, oh, wait a minute, that's not consistent with the principles upon which our nation was founded, such as, you know, principle 21, strong local self-government is the keystone to preserving human freedom, or principle 19, only limited and carefully defined powers were supposed to go to the federal government, and all others were supposed to be retained by the people and to the states respectively, or principles 2 and 3, where only virtuous and morally strong people could maintain this government. And this is why we needed to elect, you know, morally stable leaders in order to maintain this sub-republic that our founders gave us. And principles 8 and 9, that our rights, our inalienable rights, they come from God, not from government. And to protect our rights, God has revealed in principle number 9, certain principles of divine law. And our founders and our ancient thinkers said that divine law was principles in the Bible. And one of my favorites, principle 26, the core unit that determines the strength of the society is our families. Therefore, the government should foster and protect that family unit. And so, you know, when you write these principles in your heart and you memorize them, you can speak them and it will kind of like silence the crowd or take your, elevate your conversation to a new level. So anyways, we're going to take a 2-month break though. After tonight, we're going to take July and August off from our live classes. So I'm going to give you a homework assignment. I want you to keep studying this summer. So I want you to listen to these 12 classes again. They're all recorded at momsforamerica.us under cottage meetings. Hit the virtual cottage meetings. You'll see the 12 introductory lessons. You'll see the 16-week Healing of America seminars. And you'll see these 12 5,000-yearly classes. So listen to a class or two a week and just kind of keep your mind thinking about, you know, these principles of liberty and freedom. Now, the last two principles we're going to talk about tonight are so applicable to today, the burden of debt, what it does to an individual and to a nation when they're embroiled in debt. And then principle 28, one of my favorites, is the sense of manifest destiny that our founders had when they did what they did. Okay, so let's turn to principle 27. The burden of debt is as destructive to freedom as is subjugation by conquest. So what they're saying here, it's almost as bad as being invaded by force, being dominated and controlled, this idea of debt. Slavery or involuntary servitude is the result of two things: subjugation by conquest, being captured or kidnapped, or succumbing to the bondage of debt. They put debt in the same category as being invaded and, you know, taken into bondage. Debt, of course, we know is the borrowing against the future, and it's spending more than we take in. It's interesting, last year, America, our revenue in 2021 was $4.05 trillion, okay? That's what we took in. But we spent $6.82 trillion. So that is a $2.7 trillion shortfall last year. Now, the founders, you know, would say, you cut back then, you cut back. You live within your means. There's a segment of society that sound more socialistic that say, well, if there's a shortfall, we just need to tax more so we can spend more. And so, you know, debt also includes a substantial compensation to creditors for the use of his money. So it's interesting that we spend $900 million a day just on interest alone in the United States for our $30 trillion national debt. $900 million a day is accrued in interest on our $30 trillion national debt. And they're saying in the near future that interest on our national debt will be the fastest growing part of our federal budget. Now, our founder said debt benumbs the human spirit. I think that's so interesting. Our founders knew that borrowing can be an honorable procedure in a time of crisis, all right? Sometimes it's necessary, but they deplored it just the same because through their experience with debt, they had seen its corrosive and debilitating effects, which usually led to corruption of individuals and nations. So in the case of individuals, debt greatly curtails, in our manual here, the freedom of the debtor. It benumbs his spirit. He can't move if he wants to. He can't get a new job. He might have to pass up opportunities, financial opportunities, and it certainly taints his feeling of happiness, his search for happiness. And there's also a sense of waste. It's kind of like the man who has to make payments on a dead horse. If the money was spent for pleasure, or even if it was spent for needs, these debts that are long since passed, it causes sleepless nights or, you know, recoiling with the burden of this grinding weight, and not to mention these exorbitant rates in paying it off. So what was the founder's attitude towards debt? Well, look, they belonged still to the age where debt was recognized as the ugly specter that it really was. And they considered frugality a virtue. Now, a virtue is an attribute of Christ. They considered frugality. Benjamin Franklin talks a lot about it. And they felt that paying back promptly was what needed to be done when it came to debt, because they knew the nature of debt was evil. And it was a form of bondage. So let's flip the page there. Thomas Jefferson said, the maxim of buying nothing without the money in your pockets to pay for it would make our country one of the happiest on the earth. So don't buy anything if you don't have the full money to pay for it. He said, Thomas Jefferson, you would sleep sounder and you would awake happier. Isn't that wonderful? So in the cottage meetings, these 12 introductory lessons, lesson number 11 is called The Law of Harvest. And it's about teaching your children principles of self-reliance, to work hard and how to manage their money kind of thing. When our kids were growing up, we had a little program called Commitment to Excellence. And it was a little work chart and they'd mark their little duties and then they'd get paid and they'd tally up each day and they'd get a quarter for each job done, and they'd have to pay 10% to a tithing and 20% to savings and 70%. They could do whatever they wanted. And it's so interesting to me at the time when I did it, I'm just like, oh, you know, let me give them a little allowance chart. But what it did, laying that foundation of working hard and not feeling like, you know, mom and dad should pay for everything, but you had your own little money, it's surprisingly how much money the kids don't ask for. And do you agree with that, Al?
Yeah, I'd like to, yes.
We're getting a little softer with the last kids in the house, but those first three kids, I mean, they're pretty darn self-reliant. And so you need to lay that foundation of, you know, earning your own money and managing it and having your little money and saving it before you buy whatever the trinket is that you want. So The founders talk about this idea of splurge spending. The founders felt the worst kind of debt is that which results from splurge spending, going into debt to enjoy a temporary luxury or extravagant living beyond one's means. There was an English author in 1893, he wrote in Vanity Fair, those feelings when he wrote about, let's see, what did he write? This is what he says. How well we live who are comfortably and thoroughly in debt. Now, does this describe today? This was written in 1893. How well we live comfortably, even though we're thoroughly in debt, how they deny themselves nothing and how jolly and easy they are in their minds. And that quote reminded me of what we saw during COVID, that, you know, a lot of people stopped going to work, but no one was too concerned about that because they were getting checks from the government, the stimulus checks. Boy, in Washington, D.C., you could get a really healthy unemployment check. And so, you know, they kind of still carried on with this extravagant living, even though we were in the midst of a pandemic. Extravagant living and waste and hazardous borrowing against the future can reduce the best of us ultimately to bankruptcy, abject poverty, and even a gnawing hunger for lack. You know, during COVID, it was interesting with those stimulus checks. I knew some people that told me they got new watches. I knew some people that went on a vacation with that money. And we have a friend out in California. She owns a resale designer purse business worth like millions and millions of dollars. And even though they're reused designer purses, they're really expensive. And she said every time a stimulus check was issued, she said the sales went through the roof. So, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we still, even though there's, you know, a foreshadowing of difficult financial days ahead, people still were continued to be, you know, living quite jolly and easily in their mind's eye. This idea of frugality for which the founders were famous was rooted in a conviction they felt that debt should be abhorred like a plague. And they perceived excessive indebtedness as really a form of cultural disease. And we're starting to see, you know, these omens of this reaping this whirlwind of just spending without, you know, thinking too hard about it with the inflation and the increase of interest rates and a recession on the horizon. So what did Benjamin Franklin say about this splurge spending? He made his fortune through frugality and financial discipline. He said, think what you do when you run in debt. This is Benjamin Franklin. You give to another power over you, over your liberty. You're ashamed to see your creditor. You fear to speak to certain people. You make pitiful, poor excuses. You even take to downright lying, he said. But poverty often deprives a man of all spirit and virtue. 'Tis hard for an empty bag to stand upright, as poor Richard truly says. So what did our founders say about concerning a national debt? Well, they felt that a nation was no different from the debts as an individual, that the fact that indebtedness was shared maybe by the whole citizenry made it no less ominous. Nevertheless, they considered it a supreme matter of importance for the survival of a free people to get out of debt and enjoy complete solvency in order to prosper. And Thomas Jefferson says that, "I, however, place economy," Jefferson said, "amongst the first and most important of republic virtues and public debt as the greatest danger to be feared." So should one generation impose its debt on the next? Now, this is a kind of a popular concept in other countries to kind of justify the practice of passing on debts incurred by one generation for the next generation to make payment. But that was not the view of the founding fathers. They felt that, you know, the wars and the economic problems and debts of one generation should be paid for by that generation who had incurred it, and that the rising generation, in order for them to be genuinely free, both politically and economically, they should not have this debt passed on to them, because it would be almost equivalent to being born into a certain amount of bondage or involuntary servitude for something they had neither subscribed to or voted upon. And literally, they considered it taxation without representation to pass on the debt to the rising generations. And Thomas Jefferson himself said that it was immoral. It was, we should consider ourselves morally bound to pay for ourselves and consequently live within the expectancy of the majority. And George Washington talks about that as well, as he tried to establish a policy of paying debt promptly, where he said there should be, this is George Washington, no pecuniary consideration is more urgent than the regular redemption and discharge of the public debt. And just before he left office, he made a final plea. One of the last things he said to Congress was to exert a greater effort to pay off the national debt for the sake of the next generation.
Thank you. Thank you, Jalini. So let's talk about the history of our national debt. So historically, and as you saw from the text as you reviewed this week, the pattern of the government until we got into the 1930s and beyond was to pay off the national debt, because there was some borrowing that went on when there's a national emergency or there's a war. But as soon as the war is over and the debt has been accumulated, the founders and subsequent administrations tried to pay that debt off as quickly as possible. In fact, Article 6 of the Constitution actually addresses the issue of debt, which actually surprised the world, because it had been throughout history, countries would borrow money from other countries and not pay it back. But the founders were very serious about that. And that actually astonished the world, that the money that they borrowed during the Revolutionary War, they actually paid back to the countries that they had borrowed from. So the founders were serious about not accumulating debt and leaving that debt to future generations, as Jalini highlighted, was considered immoral. So through the years, however, when you have a high level of debt, and I think we can all relate to what I'm going to say here, when there's a high level of debt, it's usually accompanied by an equal increase in the cost of government operations. So as we borrow more money, then government operations go up. In fact, I want to share a slide with you that highlights this notion, because the first time this occurred was during, actually, before I do that, I want to highlight something, Jalini, that you highlighted in your talk. I just actually presented this yesterday to my clients out here in Utah, and that big orange part of the pie there, that 70% of our budget goes to mandatory spending. So what's mandatory spending? Mandatory spending are entitlement programs such as Social Security, Medicare, the required interest we have to pay on the debt. And these mandatory spending accounts count for about 2/3 of all federal spending. So if you look here in the green, you've got 5% of the federal budget outlay. And that's, as Jalini highlighted, it's a little over, this is from 2020, $6.5 trillion. The interest on that was 5%. And that green part is getting bigger. Non-defense discretionary spending was at 14%. Defense discretionary spending is at 11%. But the government has to do the mandatory spending before we get into defense and non-defense related issues. So you can see there the growing trouble that we're in based on those entitlements. And people, we've created a feather bed for our people. And people will complain about the debt. They will march in the streets and protest, but when it comes to their check that they get, it then becomes a problem. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. So when you look at this picture, was taken from the Depression. And so when I talk about increase in government operation spending, along with that increase in debt, it really hit home during the Depression. And before we got to the Depression in the 1930s, the foundation, the groundwork was laid by what's in the chart here regarding increased spending. We created in 1913 was a very, very bad year. We created the Federal Reserve, where it opened the door to take us off the gold standard, which then allowed it, this consortium of private banks, to print money and appease the Congress's desire to spend money. And that came to be about because in 1913, we also passed the 16th Amendment, which allowed the Congress to go right around the states and go directly to the people to tax them. And then the 17th Amendment, which violated the principle of separation of powers and checks and balances, where our senator was originally supposed to protect the resources of the nation and the freedoms of the people. But when the 17th Amendment was passed, and the senator, instead of being chosen and appointed by the state legislatures, they were now subject to popular vote. And the best way to stay in office is to take from those who have and give to those who have not. So then you start to get incredible deficits. And then a Supreme Court decision in 1936 called the Butler case, which opened the door for more federal spending because the general welfare clause in the Constitution was now being redefined, and it opened the door for Congress to spend money on anything they wanted to do. And Jalene highlighted this beautifully because secondarily, the people through their ignorance, when we move further and further away from the principles of religion, morality, and knowledge, and learning about the leading features of the Constitution, people become ignorant. And then they're led to believe things such as these shortcut policies around the Constitution. People are being told that that's going to lead to quick economic prosperity, that spending vast amounts of borrowed money would lead to prosperity. And have we heard that in spades? And Jalene highlighted that beautifully when she talked about the COVID checks. The COVID stimulus checks led to higher rates of unemployment as people didn't want to go back to work. The current welfare system, which we have right today, costs vast amounts of money. They've created dependence and replaced work with welfare, and also took the father out of the home and encouraged the mother to instead of marrying the father of her child, to marry the government. So splurge spending, as I highlighted before, is habit forming, particularly if the structure of government encourages it. And that was done to the creation of the Federal Reserve, the 16th and 17th Amendments. So in 1960, the federal budget was less than $100 billion. The federal government in FY21 spent $6.82 trillion. And Jalene highlighted some of those numbers. And we only collected a little over $4 trillion. So there's an automatic deficit there. And what we collect through income taxes, which the 16th Amendment allows, and also from corporate taxes. And that chart that I showed you previously, at some point, that green piece of the pie there will exceed what we spend on defense. So the Congress just marked up, the House Appropriations Committee just marked up the National Security Defense Spending Bill to the tune of $782 billion. $782 billion. So how do we fix this mess? First thing we have to do is we have to, and in this order, repeal the 17th Amendment to restore the principles of separation of powers and checks and balances. That means we make the senator now subject to the power and the direction of the states, where the states now will appoint the senator and also pay that senator's salary. So that senator will go home every weekend and take direction. And then he or she will be put back into that responsibility of protecting our freedoms, protecting families from a runaway federal government, and preserving the resources of the country. Secondly, we would repeal the 16th Amendment, thereby cutting off the money supplied to the federal government, forcing them to stay within Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which highlights the 20 enumerated powers that the Constitution gives them. And then we would enact legislation which doesn't need a congressional amendment to the Constitution. We would enact legislation to repeal the Federal Reserve. Okay, Julene, back to you.
Oh, you explain things so well. Sometimes I have to ask Al, hey, I don't quite understand this. And so thank you for, that was well done, sweetheart. I think I do understand it a little bit better. All right, we're on our last principle. This is one of my favorite principles. Have you heard me say that a few times? But really, Principle 28 is like the war cry of the champion of the camps. So I've just been studying about little David and Goliath, and Goliath was the champion of the camp. But whoever, you know, can wake up and understand, you know, we've got a cause we're fighting for, and they prevail, they're the champion of the camp. Well, I think this principle should be our war cry, because we are champions of the camp. And so, you know, as I've been studying in the Old Testament about these mighty men of valor and mighty women of valor as well, Joshua and Gideon and King David's elite, you know, men, 37 men that were like, you know, they had unusual strength and courage and passion and strength of mind and spirit. And when they encountered difficult and dangerous situations, they had a firm mind. And it's not that they were just so athletic, but it's interesting that these mighty men and women of valor also had an established relationship with God, and they were known for their bravery. Now, the opposite of bravery is apathy. And I believe right now in this country, we have an epidemic of apathy. So when you really understand this 28th principle that we're going to talk about, when it's written deep in your heart, you become convicted and you are compelled to be a doer. You're not okay with saying all is well, all is at ease in Zion. And just like that young David, just before he went up against Goliath, he said, look, is this not a cause? We got to stand up and fight this giant. We've got a cause here. Is this not worth fighting for? And our founders understood the cause of the American, you know, this miracle of freedom that they had put forth. They knew that the United States had a manifest destiny to be an example and a blessing to the entire human race, that what God had inspired them to do was not only going to elevate and bring to fold and prosper the people that lived here, but they wanted to elevate all civilizations around the world as being a light on the hill. All historians agree that the most singular an important feature of the settlers of America was this overpowering sense of those that came, this sense of mission, a conviction that they were taking part in the unfolding of a manifest destiny, a divine design, which would shower blessings on all mankind. Historian John Fisk, he was born in 1842, this John Fisk, he wrote that the founders, they believed they were doing a wonderful thing. They felt that they were instruments in accomplishing this manifest destiny, that their exodus from Europe in the 1700s, was that of a chosen people who were at length going to lay the everlasting foundation of God's kingdom on earth. Okay, this is what John Fisk wrote in 1842. This is what the founders felt. And as you go through their readings, they do talk about how they felt that they were a remnant of the house of Israel being led to a promised land. And that if they were faithful to the covenant promise of God to always remember him and to observe his laws, that they would receive that blessing, so forth, of kind of like the blessing of the Abrahamic covenant on ancient Israel, that they would be blessed. This umbrella of protection would be put over this land. And that this steadfast faith in an unseen ruler and guide was to them like a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, just like the Lord led Moses and the children of Israel across the wilderness. And it was a great moral value to them. and it gave them this idea of manifest destiny and being led by God, a sense of purpose and a concentration of strength. Like, we are going to be the champions of this camp. This is a cause worth fighting for. And it contributed towards making them like the children of Israel, a people of indestructible vitality and aggressive energy. Don't you love that? And don't you think that's maybe how George Washington felt? When we talk about this in the Healing of America seminar, number one, section three, that vision that George Washington had at Valley Forge, where he talks about this angelic visitor coming and showing him, you know, the history of America and its beginning and its middle and its end. And it just, this vision fueled George Washington to be fearless in the eye of the enemy when the little ragtag army never should have beat the best army and navy in England at that time. And so it was extremely important, however, to distinguish between this sense of mission and this and the spirit of, our book puts it, perverted chauvinism associated with the idea of racial superiority, because one is a call to exemplary leadership and service, and the other is this arrogant presumption of, you know, us feeling like we're better than others. And John Adams talks about this notion. John Adams says, "I always consider the settlement of America with reverence and wonder as the opening of a grand scene and design in Providence for the illumination of the ignorant and the emancipation of the slavish part of mankind all over the earth." Thomas Jefferson looked upon the development as freedom under the Constitution as the world's best hope. That's what Jefferson said. And John Dickinson, who was a founding father from Pennsylvania and Delaware, who the Dickinson's College in Pennsylvania is named after, John Dickinson said that what has been accomplished in the United States will be a standing monument, an example for the aim and imitation of the people of other countries. Our founders understood this work that they were doing. And it's interesting that they knew that the responsibility which had been placed upon them to perform was a mighty task. And it was a miraculous task. And it was, you know, the God of the universe was backing them on this, because they by themselves could not have done it. John Adams says, "The people of America have now the best opportunity and the greatest trust in their hands that Providence ever committed to so small a number." And Hamilton, who Alexander Hamilton, who we know would go on to become the Secretary of Treasury under Washington, said, "It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country by their conduct and example to decide the important question whether societies of men really are capable or not of establishing good governments from reflection and choice, or whether they will forever be destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident or force." And Hamilton would go on to say that if the United States failed at this mission, it would operate to the general misfortune of mankind. And John Adams would state that if the people abandon the freedoms gained by the adoption of the Constitution, it would be treason against the hopes of the world. It would be, in a sense, betraying one's country. It would be a crime. It would be treasonous. Okay, honey, take it on home.
Okay, thanks, Jalini. I want to share the statement from the text from John Jay, who was the first Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Jay. Jillian, where is he from?
One of the 13 from up north colonies. Somewhere?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that narrows it down. Thank you. So this is an interesting statement, because I read it and I thought about it at length as I was walking through the airport, being on the plane, being out here out west, and being around people. And this quote struck a tone with me, and I want to share it with you. It says, "With equal pleasure, I have often taken notice that Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs, and who, by their joint councils, arms, and efforts, fighting side by side throughout a long and bloody war, we have nobly established their general liberty and independence." And I like that notion of when John Jay, of course, I'm sure didn't spend a whole lot of time with people that look like me, but we all descended from the same ancestors. And we all speak the same language, and we all had that common religion, and we had a religion in common, that we all worship the same God, and we're very similar in our manners and our customs. We love our families. There's so many good people that are in the country, and I think we lose sight of that as we watch the news and go on social media and so forth, and we just see the worst of everything. And I think that's done by design, but there's so many good people that are around us who want what's best for themselves and for their families. And everyone that we come in contact with, particularly those who are enemies of freedom, they are entitled to have their own Saul on the way to Damascus Paul experience. So we can't give up on them. And that's why it's so important to write these principles on our hearts. So, because these principles are universal and they resonate, and they don't care what you look like or what party you represent. These principles are godly. He goes on to say, "This country and this people seem to have been made for each other. And it appears as if it was a design of Providence that an inheritance so proper and convenient for a band of brethren united to each other by the strongest ties should never be split into a number of unsocial, jealous, and alien sovereignty." So he's admonishing us there to just stick together, to look for the good in each other. I love what Cleon, Dr. Skousen, wrote in the text. He says, "The founders knew they were sailing into uncharted waters, and they knew their ship of state was entirely different from anything else on the face of the earth. True, they had examined every kind of political operation known to man, and they had abstracted from history every lesson and precaution they could learn, but their own product was unique, bold, and filled with promise of a better day." So with the guiding hand of Providence inspiring these men, and through the work that they did, that they put in to study history, to learn different languages, to see what worked and what didn't work, to take the practical experiences that they had before and through the Revolutionary War, and with inspiration from God, put it all together so that we can enjoy what we have today. And let that be a model for us. Self-study, life's about preparation. Self-study, and then when we have that coupled with the inspiration from God, we can move mountains. And so I encourage us to look for the good in America, and let's build on what we have and build on the good things. So one of the things that I am fortunate to do is I serve on the board of the Woodson Center, and our mission is to heal communities from within. So what we do is we go into these communities and we look for those individuals that are doing things the right way. And then we build on that. We call them our Josephs. And then we match those Josephs with the Pharaohs that have resources to help them ascend. And then we ask those individuals and encourage them to become agents of uplift in their own communities. And so as we arm ourselves with this knowledge, as we continue to study and write these principles on our heart, we can build on the good things that are in America. And I want to close with James Madison's comment here that he made, and that Dr. Skousen repeated in the text, and James Madison was known as the father of the Constitution. He says, happily for America, happily we trust for the whole human race that pursued a new and more noble course. They accomplished a revolution which has no parallel in the annals of human society. They reared the fabrics of governments which have no model in the face of the globe. They formed this government, brand new, first free government in modern times. They formed the design of a great confederacy, which is incumbent on their successors to improve and perpetuate. Improve and perpetuate. That's what the founders had in mind when they wrote Amendment 5 of the Constitution, Article 5 of the Constitution, which allows for amendments to be added to the Constitution, but with the hope of improving on what they did and perpetuate it. And when we talk about perpetuation, we're talking about the 28 principles that we just studied these last, what was it, Julian? Has it been 20, 25 weeks, 12 weeks?
Yeah, like 25 to you, probably.
So the last, yeah, so what we've been studying here, that's what the founders want us to perpetuate, those 28 principles. Okay, Jelani, I think I'm done. I'm back to you for a concluding, your concluding remarks.
Oh, that was so good, honey. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've studied these 28 principles that our founding fathers said must be understood and perpetuated by all people who desire peace, prosperity, and freedom. And I think of you. This is you. You wouldn't have sacrificed each Thursday night to be here if you didn't desire peace, prosperity, and freedom. Truly, adherence to these principles has brought about more progress than had been experienced in the previous 5,000 years. This is why they are part of the solution to the healing of families and schools and states and our constitution and our country. And so this should not be a one-time study of these principles. If any of you want to start teaching this 5,000 yearly class, gather 5-6 people in your neighborhood. We'll give you all the PowerPoints that we'd use. We'll try and be as helpful as possible. I put my telephone number in the chat for the next 2 months. If you have any questions about anything when it comes to cottage meeting, you can certainly reach out to Maria or you can text me and we can go back and forth. And if we need to talk, we can. You know, look, you wonderful moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas, to me, you really do remind me of the mighty men and women of valor. Now, I know you might think, well, there's not a lot of us out there in the world, in the country. But remember, God works through small means to bring about his purposes. You know, he does in the Bible. He did in the Revolutionary War. 3% of people were actually involved in fighting on the side and cause of freedom. I was just reading yesterday about this wise woman in 2 Samuel chapter 20. Verses 19, when the armies of King David were going to come and destroy her city because there was a wicked man by the name of Sheba that was undermining the government and wanted to kill David. And so the leader of King David's army, Joab, was going to just wipe out the whole city because this bad man was in the city. And this wise woman rises up in verse 19. She doesn't even have a name. They just call her a wise woman. And she goes before this leader, Joab, and she says, why are you going to destroy our city and a mother in Israel? Why? And Joab says, I don't want to do that, but there's this wicked man holding out and he's going to be the demise of our government. And so she says, look, and it's interesting that they would choose while everyone was holed up, worried that the armies of David were going to come upon them, that she was the one that chose to represent this city. And, you know, it makes me think that sometimes when the Lord needs something done, he's going to rise up a woman. And that's okay, men and women. And we're going to be helpers in this war because we really are warring for the souls of our children. And for our grandchildren, I mean, we're living it right now. We're feeling it every day that, you know, these wise women of the cities and wise dads and grandmas and grandpas, as we band together. And you know what she said to this you know, head of the army, she said, okay, I'm going to band together the people in the city and we're going to get this. His name was Sheba. We're going to cut off his head and we will throw it over the wall. And then will you leave us alone? And Joab said, yes, I don't want to destroy your city, but if you don't do something about this evil, you know, I'm going to have to destroy everyone. And so it just makes me think as I read that story, I'm like, we are like helpers in this war, in this really cause of Christ. And, you know, she knew what she was defending. She had to root out, along with the people, this evil so that they could be spared and saved. And I thought, you know, we got to be like these wise, this wise woman and these elite men of valor in scripture. And, you know, we need to be peaceable and faithful, but we need to be strong in our beliefs and courageous to stand and protect all that we love and to cast out that which is going to bring harm to our children, to our schools and our communities. I was so happy to see that that Buzz Lightyear that Disney has woven in an LGBTQ, you know, theme of, in that movie that came out. Such popular. My kids loved it. What? 15 years ago when it came out, but that it had a very bad first opening box office weekend. And I'm like, that was the moms and dads and grandparents rising up saying, we're not going to give our money to Disney anymore that is deliberately trying to indoctrinate and undermine morally our children. And I think the message was, if you get woke, you might go broke. And that is what we can't, you know, we have to cancel our Disney subscriptions and maybe not go to Disney or not solicit things that we know are purposely, you know, causing harm. We've got to cut off the heads of these people that are causing harm so we can preserve our families and our communities and neighborhoods. So what do mighty men and women of valor do? They look to God for freedom, not government, not Washington, D.C., not, you know, checks from the government. We look to God for solutions and healing and government, and we keep that family close. We make family time a high priority. Whether you start devotionals or you're grandma and grandpa and you send out little text devotionals to your grandchildren or to your adults, God will put it on your heart how you can keep your family close. And we also study these principles of freedom in the Constitution. And, you know, this is why I'm going to give you that homework assignment to keep listening to the classes, the Healing of America seminars, the 5,000 year leap and those 12 introductory lessons. And, you know, put it out there to the universe, write a little list. If I were to invite 5 or 6 or 7 women or have an evening class for men and women in my home, who would it be? Write it down, ask the Lord to give you the courage to somehow reach out, put it out there in the universe, put it on your social media, and you might be amazed at the like-minded people that will come finding you. And, you know, as you do those three things, you will just automatically know you must do something. And remember, if you want to start a cottage meeting, we'll help you. We've got all the resources. We'll give you all the PowerPoints, everything we can. But just keep coming online as well, because ultimately your heart does get pricked that I need to do something here. You know, maybe I need to start going to some school board meetings or testifying or maybe even running for a position or supporting a good candidate, that kind of thing. And so, all right, everyone.